from the campus of Stanford University.
Now, DNA contains the blueprints for how your cells live, how they grow, how they interact with other cells.
This is the future of everything.
Like a computer program, it allows the cell to perform simple computations to make decisions about when and where things happen.
With your host, Russ Altman.
Today on the future of everything, the future of brain science. Now, in 2014, the U.S. National Institutes of Health launched something called the Brain Initiative. It was a bold 12-year plan to accelerate our understanding of the brain and the diseases that affect it, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, depression, schizophrenia, many others. And it was bold. And there was a commitment of at least $5 billion made from the government and the NIH. Now, the interesting thing about this initiative is that it was roughly divided into two phases. The first phase would be about the creation of new technologies to measure, intervene in the molecules, cells, cellular connections within the nervous system and the brain. And then the second phase was going to be using these amazing new technologies, they anticipated, to understand disease and perhaps try to find new treatments, new diagnostics. So the first phase has been going now for about 6 years. There's been remarkable advances in our ability to image and measure the brain in fine detail. This includes not just the physical structure of the brain, but also the ability to see how the brain is working, the brain at work, which cells are turned on, which cells are talking to other cells, and how they work under normal conditions as well as under disease conditions. There are new ways to watch the brains as they develop. There are mathematical and computational models for how information travels around the brain, and new ways to measure and control electrical activity in the neurons or brain cells. Many of these technologies are based on innovations in physics. And as we enter the next phase, the second phase that I described, there are high expectations that these technologies will give insights that will help advance both diagnostics and treatments for some of the diseases that plague many of us. Professor Mark Schnitzer is a professor of biology and applied physics at Stanford University. His research focuses on neural circuits, the connections between sets of brain cells or neurons that lead to important brain functions such as learning and memory. His group combines behavior, electrical brain activity, imaging, and computation to model these activities. So Mark, there's been this revolution in our ability to watch neurons communicating in living organisms while they're doing stuff. What are the advancements precisely, and what do they promise to teach us?
Thank you, Russ. The advancements have been several fold. So, you know, one of the major advancements of the Brain Initiative, which you mentioned in your introduction, has been a systematic investigation of the different cell types, the different neuron types that the mammalian brain has. And this basic parts list was not even available to us before the initiative began. And so just, first of all, knowing a lot more about the constituents of the brain has been an important advance in animals, and it's coming up in primates and in the human brain. So we know what we're dealing with in a sense. There have also been important strides in our ability to make precise experimental manipulations of chosen cell types, chosen by the experimenter, that is, yes. Who might wish to tweak or, manipulate the properties or the firing patterns of individual cells. This general approach, a lot of it was started actually at Stanford by our colleague Carl Deisseroth, and his collaborators and other labs around the world. But it's since expanded into a multitude of different approaches. On the imaging side, there have been a number of new techniques for watching brains in action at cellular level resolution. Mm-hmm. So we can actually see what individual neurons, collections of neurons and neural circuits are doing during specific behaviors, and how those patterns of neural activity might underlie different things that an animal might do.
So let me, if I could stop you there, you've said two things that I want to make sure we define. Earlier in your comments, you said neurons were firing, and I want to make sure we all understand what a firing neuron is. And then you talked about these neural circuits, which I also made a kind of a vague allusion to in my opening comments. And if you could give us an understanding not only of what firing is, but what would constitute a neural circuit?
Sure. So firing is sort of a colloquial expression, actually, in our field. And more technically, it refers to the fact that neurons emit what are called action potentials. And these are a stereotyped electrical waveforms that are the basic unit, if you will, by which neurons communicate with one another. And this has been known actually for decades. Nearly all, but not all neurons emit these action potentials, or spikes as they're sometimes called. And so you'll hear the phrase, you know, firing spikes or firing action potentials. And you should sort of imagine an electrical packet, if you will, that's being transmitted down a neuron's axon. And when it reaches the terminal of that cell called the axon terminal, this is where the neurotransmitter will be released and received by a so-called postsynaptic neuron to complete the neuron-to-neuron transmission. So with that in mind, a neural circuit actually is sort of the collection of many neurons, which may have a particular pattern of synaptic or interconnections amongst them. And what we find in many instances, actually, that there is a cohesive nature to their activity, their ensemble activity, or their population activities, it's often referred to, that is not, say, predicted in a straightforward manner from the properties of the individual cells. So it's a little bit like what we see in physics, for example, that, you know, the properties of condensed matter don't follow, you know, immediately from the properties of the individual, you know, atoms or molecules. There's a collective nature to the behavior, and we see that in the brain as well.
Great. Okay, so I interrupt. Thank you very much. So I interrupted you, but you were talking now about some of the imaging innovations, and I know you've been part of all of this.
Right. So, you know, historically, the field has been limited by its ability to monitor the action of neurons. Traditionally, neuroscientists used to use electrical recording techniques, and we still very much do. This involves, in the live brain at least, the insertion of one or more electrodes into brain tissue. Electrodes are brought into close contact or nearby neurons, and they can pick up electrical signals from these cells and actually detect when they are firing action potentials, as we were just discussing. There also are imaging techniques that can watch neurons that are literally in the process of communicating information to other cells. And one of the limitations in the field had been simply being able to watch enough neurons to get sort of this overall picture of what the collective activity was. So for example, you know, when I was in graduate school, the limits might be around, say, 50 neurons. And progress in this area has, to be honest, has gone beyond where I thought the field might take us, even in our career. We're now routinely recording from thousands of neurons or more. We can do this in awake behaving animals, and it's giving us a far more complete picture of neural circuit activity and brain activity than we've ever had in the past.
When you can see 1,000 neurons, does that get you most circuits or some circuits? I'm trying to understand if 1,000 neurons will cover most of these circuits that you were describing, or if 10,000 would be even better for a lot of important circuits.
That's a terrific question. And of course, it's, you know, very important in the context of the fact that the brain has even, you know, many more neurons, right? You know, on the order of, you know, many billions. So it's reasonable to say, well, okay, so you're getting 1,000 now, whereas you had 50 before. You know, is that actually a notable advance? And the answer actually is yes, it is. Because, you know, oftentimes in an individual experiment, we will be watching cells of a given area. You know, for example, visual cortex, if you're trying to understand visual processing, motor cortex, or other motor areas, if you're trying to understand the generation of motor actions and so forth. And what we find in many cases is that to discern or to deduce the underlying principles by which the neurons are acting together and essentially constructing, whether it be visual processing or behavior and so on and so forth. In many cases, about 1,000 neurons is actually sort of the number that you need, not to get obviously the whole picture in totality, you're not getting every cell, but to begin to deduce the underlying principles. In many cases, that scale is about the right scale. And we have specific quantitative evidence for that in a number of systems.
Now, this is the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Schnitzer about brain science and some of the advances in imaging and other measurement technologies to understand these brain circuits. So Mark, tell me about some of the applications, questions that you can now start to ask with these technologies.
Right. So one of the areas that my lab has been involved in, and now others have adopted the technology that I'm about to tell you about, is that we were very focused on being able to image neural activity, and in particular, neural circuit activity, the activity in populations of cells, when animals were awake and behaving. And the reason we wanted to do that is that in many cases, in many neural systems, you will not actually see the pattern of neural activity that you're interested in unless the animal is doing the behavior that is associated with that activity.
Sure,
so for example, if you want to understand, say, you know, movement generation, the animal has got to be moving. And so whatever recording technique you might apply, it's got to be usable under those kind of conditions. And so with my colleague at Stanford, electrical engineering professor Abbas Al-Gamal, and our joint PhD student, Kunal Ghosh, and other colleagues, we came up with a head-mounted miniature microscope that is small and light enough that an adult mouse can actually bear on its head, like a little hat.
So this is not a human head. This is a mouse head, which
means
it can't
be
very heavy, I'm going to guess.
No, it's in between 2 and 3 grams. And they can wear it on the head, and it is small and light enough that they can behave naturally across a wide range of different behaviors. And in conjunction with that little microscope hat, if you will, I had been working for a number of years, starting when I was at Bell Labs, on micro-optical probes that could be directly inserted into brain tissue. And these come in different diameters and lengths and can be targeted to an experimenter's brain area of choice. Okay. And the combination of those two technologies, these micro-optical probes or microendoscopes, as we sometimes call them, plus the little microscope hat, if you will, the miniature microscope to receive the images at the backside of the probe, actually allows us to visualize cells in a chosen brain area across a wide set of different animal behaviors.
Very cool. Very cool. So do the mice then get diseases that we can then study? I'm getting a little greedy here, but I'm jumping to the diseases because it sounds like you can study these circuits both in normal behavior and abnormal, I'm guessing?
Absolutely. And so this is where sort of our approach was able to interface, if you will, with some of the other advances that had been made by other groups in neuroscience. So we are able to ask a lot of questions about the basic function of the brain, but we are, as you suggest, able to apply these approaches to the study of animal disease models of human conditions. And in particular, the brain research community and the funding bodies that supported it have put a lot of effort over multiple years into creating animal models of human brain disease. And there are now readily available a wide set of models for different brain diseases and disorders. And so now that we have new technology for tracking the patterns of neural activity in the healthy brain, we can also apply those approaches toward understanding what might go wrong in some of these models of brain disease. And that's giving us new insights.
What are the kinds of things that you discover, even if we can't get into the details for any particular disease?
Yes, thank you. Let me tell you about a study that my lab did in collaboration with Jones Parker and also Mike Ehlers. So we were interested in exploring some longstanding ideas about Parkinson's disease, in which a patient will suffer impediment of movement.
Yes,
and
yes.
there have been the longstanding hypothesis that perhaps this difficulty of movement reflected an imbalance of activity across the two major pathways in the basal ganglia. So it was thought that maybe one of the pathways was overactive and another pathway was underactive, was hypoactive. But this idea had not yet been directly tested. Mm-hmm. And with the miniature microscope technology, we were able to go into the striatum, an input nucleus of the basal ganglia, and actually directly test in mouse models of Parkinson's disease that, in fact, not only did this imbalance truly exist, but also that there were deficits in how movements were encoded in a Parkinsonian brain.
Wow. So that's exactly what I asked for. So you guys went into, and I'm assuming that these are pretty good models so that they match the human version of Parkinson's disease. I know that this is always a question, is the mouse Parkinson's similar enough to the human Parkinson's to give good data? But let's assume that that's a good model. You found that this theory was upheld about this kind of this imbalance. And it sounds like with these thousands of neural circuits, you're able to characterize some of the details of how those things are misregulated.
in our particular model, we had induced a Parkinsonian state by actually depleting the dopamine neurons. And the loss of dopamine neurons is, of course, one of the hallmark features of Parkinson's disease in the human condition. And so, you know, indeed, as you say, we were able to directly attain evidence for this imbalance. But interestingly, we were able to go beyond the model and find the features that were not predicted by the model. And in particular, was this loss of movement coding. And then the other interesting thing about this is that, you know, of course, given its complexity, brain activity can go awry in a number of different ways. And there's a condition called dyskinesia that many Parkinson's disease patients suffer in the late stages of the disease. And this is intimately tied with the mainstay treatment for Parkinson's disease, namely the administration of L-DOPA, dopamine precursor. And unfortunately, there's an effect called the waning efficacy, whereby after a long-term course of treatment with L-DOPA, patients will often develop a hyperkinetic movements or involuntary movements. And so this is called L-DOPA-induced dyskinesia. And what's interesting is that L-DOPA-induced dyskinesia in many ways has an opposite set of movement symptoms as Parkinson's disease itself. In Parkinson's disease, there's an impediment to movement, and the other case, there's a hyperkinesis. What was very interesting is that we were able to treat our Parkinsonian mice with L-DOPA, and with the right dosage, we were able to restore normal patterns of brain activity and normal patterns of mouse behavior. But if we gave too much L-DOPA, we would then induce a dyskinetic state. And what was very fascinating is that we saw in the basal ganglia and the striatum the opposite pattern of neural symptoms, meaning the opposite set of imbalances. So what we had found was that these two different disease conditions, which are characterized by opposite symptoms, in fact, were also associated with opposite neural symptoms.
Yeah, I just want to highlight that, because if I'm understanding you, this is a huge deal, because we're moving from a symptomatic understanding of Parkinson's disease and dyskinesia, where doctors are describing what's wrong with the patient at a macro level. Now you're finding the correlates in these neural circuits that explain and correlate with those more macro features. But that is exciting to me, because then I can imagine a detailed understanding of how to intervene in those circuits. And it sounds like you're already getting there with perhaps a precision dosing of a medication to hit it exactly at the right spot and to avoid over or underdosing.
That's right. That's right. So in other words, you can begin to use this as a readout to know, you know, when your, say, new treatment has, you know, got it correct, that you've rebalanced activity appropriately, that the circuit is now properly encoding the desired movement actions. You know, there's no hyperkinesis, there's no impediment to movement, and so forth. And so this basic idea of rebalancing or renormalizing neural circuit activity, we think is one that will apply not just to Parkinson's disease and dyskinesia, but hopefully to other syndromes and conditions. And so perhaps we can generalize in a fruitful way.
This is the Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. More with Dr. Mark Schnitzer about brain science and the breakthroughs that are coming from the Brain Initiative next on Sirius XM.
The Future of Everything with Russ Altman from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Professor Mark Schnitzer about brain science. And we were just talking about some remarkable discoveries of the details of the neural circuits in Parkinson's disease. And Mark, I know you've also worked on pain, both chronic pain and maybe even acute pain. That's a very different thing than Parkinson's disease, because first of all, it's much more ubiquitous across the population and people have extremely different experiences of pain. So I imagine, without knowing anything, that this might be a little bit more of a difficult thing to approach, but I might be wrong. So what are the questions for pain, and what have you been observing?
So here again, we were able to take advantage of the miniature microscope technology. And in this particular study, which was a collaboration with Professor Greg Scheer, we were able to look inside the brain and actually discern the manner, if you will, in which the pain experience is created by neural circuit activity. So there had been previous evidence suggesting that the amygdala might be involved in painful experience.
And this is part of, the amygdala is part of your core brainstem?
Not the brainstem, but it's a highly evolutionary conserved portion of the brain. And I should say, it's involved in the creation of emotional experience. So the amygdala is crucially involved in the creation or the dynamics that underlie both positive and negative emotional experience.
Okay.
And this is important for our discussion of pain, because one of the hallmark features of pain is how unpleasant it is. It's universally
pretty much by definition.
It is almost universally perceived as unpleasant, and so there's actually a lot of very strong emotion associated with pain. Yes. And this can be very debilitating for patients with.
And my understanding is it can go the other way in the sense that if you're already in a bad emotional place, pain can be perceived as much worse than if you were not in such an emotional place.
There are mutual interactions between these kind of effects. So we were interested in what particular role was the amygdala actually playing? And so using the microendoscopes and the miniature microscope that we discussed with Greg Scherer's group, we directed the microendoscope to the basolateral amygdala, a particular portion of that area. And we actually discovered a subset of neurons that seemed to be especially involved in the representation of the encoding of pain experience.
Huh.
And then what was fascinating about these neurons was that they were required in a sense for the emotional component of pain. So for example, when we, after having found these cells, when we silenced them using various experimental tools, we found that the animal retained its reflexive withdrawal responses to pain. So its immediate sensation, if you will, but greatly diminished were the so-called affective or motivational responses to pain. So it was as if the animal didn't care as much and didn't perceive it as unpleasant. Oh. So it seems that these neurons were critically involved in that process by which pain gains its very strong emotional qualities.
That's absolutely huge because if you could then turn this into a way to help people manage the emotional sequelae of pain, or the mice first and then people later, that could be a huge breakthrough in the management, especially of chronic pain, where it just takes a toll on the patient over many months and years.
It opens up the possibility of perhaps new therapeutics for pain. So one of the features of a chronic pain state that patients experience is a phenomenon known as allodynia. And in allodynia, a chronic pain patient will perceive a stimulus that most of us would take as innocuous. They will perceive it as painful, okay? And what we found was that in mice, for example, that had a peripheral nerve injury and which exhibited behavioral symptoms of allodynia, including to cold stimuli, for example, these pain-encoding neurons in the amygdala were responding abnormally to stimuli that are normally benign or innocuous. So in other words, this is a neural substrate, if you will, for allodynia. And we were able to essentially cure that in the mice by tamping down activity selectively in this set of cells without affecting withdrawal reflexes. You know, in a sense, it's easy to make a patient, you know, numb in many cases, but we don't want to do that. What you want therapeutically is to retain normal reflexes, normal somatosensation, and selectively target, in this case, a painful experience. So that's selectivity of this treatment, at least in mice, really caught our eye and made us think that there could be new, you know, therapeutic avenues in the future for humans.
So these set of cells really sound remarkable. And it leads to a couple of questions for me. First of all, can you find those cells reproducibly in different mice? In other words, you said it was the basolateral part of the amygdala. And I'm wondering, are they reliably there and you can find them so that you can manipulate them? Or does it require very invasive monitoring to figure out exactly which cells are the ones that you need to manipulate?
Yeah, so they are reliably there. You know, we see them essentially in each and every mouse.
Right.
The way that we have done this is a couple different ways. So if we target the microendoscope, we can actually visualize them directly in the sense that we will see these neurons fire in response to, for example, a pinprick.
Yep.
So, or, you know, other types of brief painful stimuli. So we can, you know, pick them out visually. There also are, you know, other methods in the field, for example, so-called chemogenetic methods, where we can genetically tag these cells by virtue of their responses to pain. But by and large, for the moment, we are defining them by virtue of their pain responses. And of course, one of the things we would like to know is to, you know, what are the molecular characteristics of these cells? Do they generalize to other species beyond mice? You know, do they exist in primates and in humans? And if so, you know, perhaps we can translate some of our very successful treatment approaches in mice
Absolutely.
In one form or another to human patients.
And that's where I wanted to go in the last couple of minutes, which is that you've already described some amazing findings in both Parkinson's and pain. Right there, you're talking about millions and millions of humans worldwide suffering from these diseases. What are the challenges moving from these very compelling findings in experimental animals and moving them to humans, where I presume some of your interventions like poking holes in people's brains and electrodes and stuff are just going to be a little bit harder to do, although not impossible. So can you paint the landscape of how this is going to move to translation where it becomes available technologies for doctors treating patients with these diseases?
You know, obviously this is going to be a complex endeavor, but I think, you know, particularly for conserved areas of the brain, you know, like the amygdala, which is, you know, highly conserved in many facets.
When you say conserved, you just mean that it's very similar across many species.
There are going to be similar features across species. You know, we expect to see similar cell types, similar patterns of connections to other brain areas, similar responses to stimuli and so on and so forth. So not that it's identical, but there's enough to go on, if you will, to make these, you know, cross species jumps. So, you know, to use the pain study as an example, if we can define the identities of these pain neurons in the mouse amygdala to a greater extent, for example, their molecular attributes, we can then go look in human brain tissue whether or not there are cells that have those exact same attributes or similar attributes. And then we could begin to test new therapeutics that might work well in the mouse on you know, molecular targets that we find in the mouse on those same conserved targets that we might find in the human amygdala.
Can you paint a picture for what these interventions might look like? Are we talking about pills or vaccines or electrodes? I know that there's a certain amount of crystal ball here, but where would you say, what are these going to wind up looking like to the patient and to the doctor?
Pharmaceuticals or drugs remain a very powerful technology. And one of the goals is to try to come up with drug treatments that are very precise. So ideally what you'd like to have is a treatment that has, you know, as few side effects as possible. And so we do have pain treatments, but they have very well established, you know, side effects. So for example, you know, taking our cells in the amygdala, one would like to be able to find a molecular feature of these neurons that you could target and which would allow you to dial down the activity of these pain responses in just these cells without affecting other neurons in the brain, without affecting, for example, breathing centers, or without inducing addiction.
Thank you for listening to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime, on demand, with the SiriusXM app.
This has been The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio.
If you missed any of it, listen on demand,
online, or with the SiriusXM app.